We're back! We're back! It's a distraction. I'm Drew. That's Roth. How you doing, Roth?
I'm good. What was wrong with the first way that you said, we're back, we're back? I thought it sounded fantastic.
You know, I wasn't happy with it, and I said, let's do a retake. And then the retake sounded really exactly the same as the first take. So, yeah. But then I was like, well, I'm not going to do it three times. That would be diva behavior.
That's what the episode that we have Stanley Kubrick guest produce for us, where you do it like 25 times and achieve a higher truth in the line.
That's right. Yeah. It's like all of a sudden, like it's like how everything always comes back to Michael Mann discussion, but the famous "she got a great ass" line from Pacino, that was like the 50th take. That was like Michael Mann being like, "Do it again." And Al Pacino was like, God, I'm so sick of fucking, I'm just going to do the stupidest fucking take I could. And then he did it. And then man's like, that's perfect. That's gold.
That's what I was going for the whole time is you turning into a weird puppet just for that one line reading.
We're using the great ass take. That's going to be perfect for our
anyway, if it makes you feel better, I jumped both times you said we're back. It was that good.
Wow.
And I knew it was coming. This isn't my first podcast episode.
I should have extra pep in my step because Kirk walked to Atlanta, but I'm not going to talk about that because we have a guest this week. It's Defector writer Catherine Hsu. Hi, Catherine.
Hey, what's up?
Hi.
That is exactly the level of enthusiasm we get from every guest on the staff. So Catherine started out as an intern at Defector, and she worked her way from the mailroom all the way up to the corner office. A true American success story, not unlike that of Robert Evans. Catherine, we're so proud of you, and we're so happy to have you on.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
Good. I'm happy that you're happy. Now, Catherine, we have to start with an overarching first question. You are a young person, Catherine. I believe
how,
you're...
How is that, Catherine? Is that nice?
Yeah, I was going to say, you're 17? I don't know. Anyway, the point is... You're a young person. What are you young people into today? What are you doing? What are you saying? What are you doing behind old people's backs? What should I, as a boomer, fear about you people?
Oh my gosh. This is funny because at the holiday party, we realized that like I was a similar age to like Roth's turtle.
Yeah.
Marvin.
It's basically a wash. It was tough.
But I do feel like I would say a kinship with Marvin. Like I have parasocial relationships with all of my coworkers' pets, but like I think Marvin and I like have a special bond because of that fact. But for like what I'm doing, I feel like it's heavily biased by like my very normal social circle that I run in, which is like moving to Philadelphia and losing at their like Tuesday night trivia or whatever. That's what my experience has looked like so far. And like I'm like such an adult now. And I'm like living alone. It's so good. It's functioning very well.
I will say that getting your ass beat at trivia is to me canonically 23-year-old person behavior. Like just in the sense that I also did it. And you, however badly you're doing, like my turtle will eat his own poop if I don't pay attention to it. Like you're way ahead of Marvin in that particular area.
I'm very happy to hear that.
I learned that turtles eat their own. Like to eat shit from Guy Fieri when I profiled Guy. It was the lead to my Guy Fieri profile because
does he have a turtle?
Yeah, he had like a tortoise, and he's like, "Let me tell you something, brother. Let me tell you something about this guy's favorite food. Like their favorite food, fresh dog shit. It is like caviar to a tortoise." I was like, "That is perfect." And I didn't tell him I was going to lead the story with that, but you better believe I fucking did. Now I want to go back for a second, Catherine. You are living alone for the first time. How long have you been living alone? And I can ask you this because you're young. You're not like 68. Like that would be much more invasive. It's like, how long have you been an old maid? Like, I'm not gonna do that.
All right. So I have a roommate who is like a high school friend. So I'm not like alone, but I'm alone in the sense that like I'm away from my parents, I guess. Which sounds great. But I've been living alone since like just after I started working at Defector. So I think I moved in at around like August or something like that. So it's been like not that long. It's been like, what, 6 months?
Yeah. Have you adjusted to living like a grown-up?
See, this is like terrible because I feel like I still have these college student habits. Like when I'm doing my morning blogs for the site, but I know that Roth is like this too. So maybe this is just what adulthood looks like. I'm like up until 4 a.m. blogging and then I wake up at 8 a.m. and I roll over in bed and I like message Tom and I'm like, oh, here's this blog. And then I take a nap later in the day.
Yeah, that's, I mean, again, I'd love to say that that's me being youthful. That might just be the blogger gland in your brain that will continue to, whatever unhelpful chemical is extruded by that is going to keep being, you know, tormenting you for the rest of your days. But that,
no, but I mean, that's how I lived when I got out of college. Like, I had my own apartment and I was still a college guy at heart. So it was like, wow, I can just, I don't have to study or anything like that. Every night at 5 when I got off of work, I have nothing else to do. I can just drink and I can just make shit on my Foreman grill. And I was like, that was a slob. It was fucking, I was fucking disgusting. Like eating Top Ramen and all that. Like, yeah, I didn't lose any of those affects. If anything, they became only more pronounced in bachelorhood, Kath.
I feel like having a roommate is, it keeps you honest to a certain extent though, that's my wife is not my roommate. She is my wife, but if I am a lot more feral, disgusting, whatever word you want to use, when she's not here.
Oh yeah.
Just because like nobody's like, why are you watching a movie right now? And then I'm like, oh, don't look at me. You know, like just having another person in the house, like canonically Drew living by himself fresh out of college to me is like the, like, you don't want to say the bottom of like possibility.
I liked that.
But that Foreman grill is like, I didn't see it, but you've told enough stories about it where I was like, no, you shouldn't do that. Like, it's basically like, in my mind, you live in like Buffalo Bills storage facility from Silence of the Lambs. Like, it's just horrible, weird, like gelatinous stuff everywhere.
No,
Catherine, is having a friend from school around, are you like more normal because there's another person there, do you think?
I would say so. I do get this feeling sometimes because it's like she's doing 2 years before she like goes to med school or whatever. So she's working at like a cancer lab right now. So she's going off to work every morning doing like cancer research. And then I'm like, well, it's time to log on and get into the blog caves.
Yep.
Which is like a very funny sort of state of our relationship, essentially. But I don't know, it's good because like she keeps like real person hours and like, and then that keeps me honest because I'm like, I don't want to like look so far behind like what she's doing.
Well, also like free doctor, right? So are you ever like, hey, can you look at this mole and make sure it's okay? Like, oh, I got a little bit of a, can you prescribe me some opioids like just for kicks? Like, you could do all that. That's really cool. Let's actually talk about your work because you're a blogger for us, Catherine. In August, and I remember this very, very well because I liked it so much, you wrote a very long story about K-pop in Korea where some groups, not all of them, a certain few, have an org chart that's more elaborate than like the one at General Motors. Some of these groups have subunits and those subunits can have up to 24 members. They can be revealed or swapped out at any time. And I wanted to ask you, given how massive K-pop is all across the world right now, including in the United States, do you think that this expansion of like what a group is and who entails in it will become more common, not only in Korea, but here in the US where the Lou Pearlmans of the world reside?
I think this is hard to a certain extent because it's like, there's no real like analog in American entertainment for K-pop groups, which seem like a pretty niche thing in Korea still. But I think that like some stuff, especially with like the business model, definitely overlap and like the monetization aspect of the group. Because I was writing this blog and I was like, what on earth is going on with this group? It's just like triple S for those curious. And like the official blogs that the company is releasing, marketing the group on like the agency's webpage, it like harps on so much about how fans are just consumers nowadays with like no agency over what they're buying, which it's like interesting because I think that that's sort of a true statement. Like with how bad everything had just sort of gotten overall, or even like the fanatic stuff. It's just like, this is true. Like fans want to spend money, but they don't actually have any real control over like what they are spending the money on.
Yeah.
And then
or how good it is or isn't. Yeah.
Well, the other thing is, and I don't mean to interrupt, but I think it's a good thing when fans don't have input because look at the state of tentpole cinema, you know, and that is, they did not, you know, Marvel didn't go and say, they didn't go survey fans and say, hey, we're going to do that. But they have focus groups. And, you know, if fanboys cry out, oh, Sonic's teeth are bad, like they will go and digitally fix them. Right. And it's like, that takes some agency away from the artist to be like, I have to make this on my own terms, and how it's received, it's received. But if you start incorporating every fucking Tom, Dick, and Harry out there into like being like, well, you should write a song about empowerment, that's bad, I think. But Catherine, I have now gone on too much of a digression. You should talk again.
No, I agree with that, because like the whole framing of this agency is like, in order to fix this issue, we're going to give fans more agency in like deciding what this group actually looks like. And then right. I think that's sort of a natural conclusion of like stan culture or whatever, which is like fans do want to have a say in like all this stuff. So it's like a sort of fan inflicted problem, because like what giving more agency looks like is basically like giving more decision points for fans to spend their money. Because the way this works is that like fans buy this like fake currency and they use this fake currency to vote. And then, you know, it's just like normally you just be buying, spending money on like albums, merch, and like concert tickets. But now there's like so many different avenues. So I don't know. It's just like bleak in that sense, because there's not even like a pretense made towards like the actual product at hand anymore, even in the sense that like, it's hard because like K-pop groups haven't ever really pretended to, like there's some marketing towards like these groups being like self-produced, but there hasn't really been that much of a pretense towards like these are actual artists at their craft, like they're performers essentially. But like all of the songs and like how the group is put together is, it's always been known that that's done by someone else.
Yeah, that's like an industrial process, basically, right?
Right, like, right.
Then they're at the sort of the tip of the spear. They have like the best hair out of anybody involved.
Well, but also that's also been true throughout music history, right? There's always been Svengalis, right? You know, like the Sex Pistols were a boy band, like, or you have like the Monkees and shit like that. Like there were always groups that were sort of they were fake bands, like they were. They were assembled by someone else with a moneyed interest. And then they didn't write the songs. They were like, you know, if someone like Katy Perry, like they just bring her a bunch of songwriter demos and they're like, pick the one you like that you think you'll do well. And she's like, oh, this one, you know? And so it's like, there's always been a bit of a manufacturing aspect of it. Doesn't mean that, and there's two things. Doesn't mean that all that product is bad, because there's a lot of mass produced pop that's been quite good. But also, there's also been a lot of instances of artists who end up chafing under that, and then they want to become, you know, they want to become Harry Styles. They want to become the Beatles. They want to become people like that.
Yeah. It's like K-pop is unique in the sense that I feel like there's a little bit more mystique on like the American level of like the process isn't as transparent as it is in Korea, because now, and this is a more recent development, because now there are these idol shows where there's like 100 trainees who come on and then the fans assemble the group themselves, which I think is sort of the tradition that this new K-pop group has sort of like come from. And I think that that's also a big part of the changing tides in K-pop, or like what has shifted. There was this debate that was going on Twitter like a week ago on like, are K-pop idols nowadays like worse at singing than they were like a generation ago in K-pop terms? So that's like 2008 or whatever.
Oh God, and, fuck them all.
Yeah, don't worry so about it. Like, she's the same age as my turtle, generation. Drew. You got to get your head around this.
God damn.
And there's this guy I follow on Twitter, which is always a great thing to say, but he's like a K-pop fan, but also a Dodgers fan. So he cracked this joke about how it seems like K-pop companies are maybe just like moneyballing it. So maybe Billy Bean was like the one ahead of the curve on like all of this stuff.
Always
because
is.
It's like if you pick a group from like a decade ago, there's like 5 to 12 people, one or two of them are like really great singers, one or two of them are like really great dancers, and one or two of them are like good on variety shows. So they're like big personalities, very funny, very personable. And I think like, especially with the fan voting shows, companies have sort of realized that like the fans are not voting for like the good singers, you know, like they're voting for the people they think are like hot or like of personable course. In like a different way. So now they're just like, well, we don't have to fill up 4 roster spots with these people who aren't even going to get us like brand deals or whatever. We can just like have 7 people who are like really hot and good at getting brand deals.
We don't need talented people. We just need all posh spices. It's fine.
Well, but this is the thing. As somebody who is fascinated by this stuff, I really like what you've written about it. I really like what Diana has written about it, which is much more straightforward as like a sort of a fan of the music.
Not just sort of a fan. She is like a gonzo,
owns the light stick, goes to SoFi Stadium and sits in the last row to watch.
She's a BTS nut. She's no doubt.
But does it matter how good they are at singing? Like, to the extent that, like, I guess this is like maybe a naive or an old guy question there, but like, what is the desired balance there? Like, the roster construction that you described makes sense to me. Like, not sense, but like, as you lay it out, I was like, yeah, that ratio seems about right. You want to maintain proper spacing. But like, what is has the template in terms of like what they're going for evolved at all? Like, could you just make an entire group out of the hot people and have them do as well as one that has a little bit of everything?
I think so, yes. Like, people have been complaining about this one group that has sort of spurred off from like one of the voting shows called like Les Seraphim, who have come under fire for like just not being able to sing. I think that it's just hard because I feel like this has been true since like the beginning of time. Like, they are not particularly unique, but they're still like massively successful. Like, they're extremely popular with the general public. Like, they get the brand deals as like rookie idols and things like that. And I mean, it's interesting because I think if you look at some of the older groups, like the most popular singers now who have gone on to have like successful solo careers are like, you have some who are like the main singer on their group, who are like really good singers. And then you have others who are like maybe not so good in terms of like raw singing or dancing, but are extremely charismatic. Like, I think that the most important thing for like a K-pop idol has always been like how good of a performer you are, which is like I would describe as like a different category from being like necessarily a good singer or dancer.
Like
X factor, you know,
no,
the intangibles.
I mean, that's true here in America too, like for like two examples. One is like Britney Spears, and that's everyone's gonna yell at me about it, but like Britney Spears is not a talented singer, right? But she is a remarkable performer. Just an incredible performer. So you don't necessarily, you know, you're the singer, that's your job. And yet there's so much more that goes into the job. Because the other one, and I swear I'm not doing this to goof on Roth, but David Lee Roth, you know, everyone like shares like the YouTubes of just David Lee Roth's vocal tracks. And they're like, ha ha, he's such a lousy singer. But like, he was the perfect singer for that band. Like, he was like, Sammy Hagar was a much more talented singer, had much more vocal range. But he had such a shittier personality that it wasn't as cool of a band with him in it. Like, you needed that sort of ludicrous, you know, sort of absurd bravado of David Lee Roth to really make the band work. And that's where you become a gifted frontman or a performer. So it's not necessarily about your pipes. Like, you can't, not everyone can be Whitney Houston, right?
Yeah. I have to recuse myself from any thing having to do with David Lee Roth. It would be biased.
Do you?
I don't.
You're a different person. We know this.
Yeah, but I think, so this is an interesting sort of distinction to me. I guess, like, to what extent, if you break free in one of these groups, Catherine, and again, I know this is really like remedial question stuff because I don't understand this as much as I'm interested in it. So you're the main singer of one of these groups. You go on to have a solo career. If you're no longer supported by that, like, well, are you supported by the sort of industrial apparatus that props up all of these different groups and is constantly generating new ones? Or are they sort of like out there on their own, like as like, you know, launched from the nest, like full-fledged adult celebrities? Does that exist in this context?
Like, there's this, I think, sort of false dichotomy that exists between like, oh, you are an idol singer or you are like an actual singer. Mm-hmm. And I think that, like, I'm using like a specific example of this artist called Taeyeon, who is a member of this like very popular girl group called Girls' Generation. And then she's now, I would say, become considered as like an actual singer, even though I still don't think like she's involved with the creation of her music, but she doesn't like write the songs, but she's like a very good singer. But she still has the support of like the people who liked the group. She was like very popular within the group. So a lot of her fans came from the group, but she's now popular like outside of that too. She's also like on this variety show that I really liked to watch. And then so a lot of like young kids who watch that show only know her from that show too. So it's like very interesting, like the different levels of like popularity you can get. Like, to a certain extent, people listen to your music. To another extent, like, you appear on, like, all the fashion stuff, which is happening with, like, all the Blackpink girls. And then, yeah.
A connection, again, between these two areas of things. You also write about baseball. Eventually, I assume we will talk about baseball.
Yeah, we are going to do it.
And we talked about Billy Beane sort of got mentioned in passing, as he does at this point. Nobody really wants to delve into Billy Beane's last 10 years. It's pretty depressing, just in terms of on-field results. But Billy Beane is a name that baseball fans know. And I think that, like, increasingly, baseball fans know not just the GMs of their teams, but the GMs of other teams, what their tendencies are, what the, you know, sort of team building process is, or, you know, in the case of, like, the Rockies or the Royals or something, whatever their values-driven corporate culture is. Is there an understanding in terms of, like, when you look at K-pop and you can see a group that is, the like, produced by one of these sorts of, like, conglomerates or processes, do you think that it's, like, common knowledge that, like, this organization produces this type of group, even, like, down to, like, stylistically, are there choices? Like, is, and also, are the names of the GMs known in this context? I know it's not a one-to-one comparison, but do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely. I think this was, like, if anything, even more true 10 years ago, because there was, like, the big three in K-pop companies, which were SM, YG, and JYP. And they were all run by, like, very famous, like, either former singers or, like, producers. And then there are what people call company stands, who really support, like, artists who come from a company, but also support the company themselves. And I feel like this is something that's, like, happened with, like, baseball fandom too.
Absolutely. Where it's, yes.
Like, that's like NASCAR shit too. Like, I ain't rooting for Honda.
Yeah.
Right. Like, people will just root for these GMs to make, like, GM decisions, like, saving money. And I'm like, as a fan, like, we need to bring back, like, the fan rage portion of, like, insisting that the artist is mistreated by their company all the time.
Like, yeah, I like that.
Like, we need to bring that back. Like, there should be, like, no more, like, support for these companies.
That's also, yeah. Like, that's, like, this, it's still the stan part of your brain. But if you have to choose between, like, getting your backup and, like, taking your leisure time, of which you have in Korea or in the United States, not enough. If you want to take that to, like, go to war for someone you'll never meet, like, at least make it somebody who's, like, hot and talented and not their boss. Like, yeah. That's, you have to respect yourself a little bit in that, in my opinion.
Well, also, I mean, how many times can you be told, how many stories do you have to hear about artists getting ripped off by their managers, by their producers, by their label, by Pebbles, like, before you're like, You know, record company people are shady. Like,
yeah,
you know,
true.
Everybody knows that.
It's a whole
we do have to dovetail to, or we do have to pivot to sports talk. But on the music front, I did want to break the news that Eric Carmen has just passed away.
Oh, R.I.P.
The Hungry Eyes singer. I had to sing Hungry Eyes in choir in middle school.
What?
When Dirty Dancing was at its peak, our. Like, they would hand out, like, we had to do that one and, like, Somewhere Out There from An American Tale and shit like that. Like, we would sing the popular songs of the time. This is about 60 years before you were born, Catherine. But
but the idea of a bunch of little kids, like, those, like, sort of high-pitched child choruses that you get, it's, like, disproportionately represented in movie trailers.
Yep.
Like, a bunch of 7-year-olds singing Radiohead's Creep while, like, Daniel Craig walks down a hallway.
You better believe, like, it, baby.
Singing Hungry Eyes with a bunch of, like, kids with either cracking voices, which is funnier, or just, like, little kid voices is a weird choice to me.
It was not somber, though. Like, it was upbeat. So, like, we adhered to the spirit of the song. We were...
You were, like, pitching it down and dirging it like they do for movie trailers?
We were hungry-eyed seventh graders. Catherine, you also cover baseball for us, so it's a good time for us to talk briefly about Major League Baseball. And not just the shitty pants. Can you tell us... Or can you at least give us a theory? Why is defending Cy Young winner Blake Snell still on the street?
To a certain extent, I think that the analytics guys are, like, you would think that the analytics guys are really into him because of the whole, like, third time through the order thing. He has, like, 3 pitches, and that's sort of, like, the breed of Major League Baseball pitcher that has been put out recently. But I also wonder if there's just been a shift towards, like, you don't want to spend big money contract on a guy who doesn't get you, like, over 180 innings a year, or who has only done that, like, twice in, like, the past 7 years, basically.
Yeah. He's also, as you said, like more or less designed as a pitcher not to get you that many innings per year. Like you
right.
he could probably physically throw 200 innings a year, but it's like the innings he's not throwing, he shouldn't be throwing. That like just the right. approach doesn't suggest that that's a good idea. It is weird though, because I feel like, do you think that there's been, because I think we're probably reading the same blogs on this, so we, whether we have the same opinions or not, we're drawing from the same sort of pool of information. So like there is a sense, like you said, that he's like perfectly optimized in his way for like the way that pitchers are used. He's also like not an efficient strike thrower. There's like things there that we've seen like analytically sort of flagged. I also feel like, I don't know, you know, to what extent he's willing to accept less. He is a Scott Boras client, but how much he's willing to accept less than, you know, he came into the offseason wanting. I kind of can't believe that he and Jordan Montgomery don't have jobs, I guess is what I'm saying. And I feel like there's been an overcorrection in both instances. There's stuff you can point to and be like, Montgomery's a little old, Snell's a little inefficient, whatever. It's also like, it's mid-March. You know, like, to what extent do you think that this is, like, not, it doesn't have the feeling of the capital strike, but like, how much of an overcorrection is this? Like, would you care? Would you be mad if Blake Snell wound up on your team with a 5-year commitment? Like, I don't feel like I would.
Yeah, I feel like any team that wants to compete and has like, well, every team has the money to do so, but like has right. the luxury cap space to do so, like should want Blake Snell, even if it is a slight overpayment, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
Like,
it does.
I think Aaron Nola has sort of messed up the, I don't know if messed up the market is the right word, but he did that like pseudo extension with the Phillies basically, and he got paid like quite a lot of money. And I think it makes sense that Blake Snell will look like that and be like, well, I want more than that because I've won the Cy Young twice and Aaron Nola, this bum, hasn't won the Cy Young once.
Yep.
And like, he had like a relatively like average-ish season like Nola did like last year too. But like Nola like eats innings insofar as like any Major League Baseball pitcher eats innings nowadays. So I do think that like there's this appeal of like, you always know what you're going to get with Aaron Nola for like however long it's going to be, but like you don't necessarily know what you're going to get from Blake Snell depending on like if he's healthy or if he's even pitching. So, and I think that teams are sort of maybe craving that reliability, or it's like the asking price that like Nola has set is like working against Snell in a certain way because like he definitely wants more, but like I don't know if teams are going to pay that much for him.
Yeah. And I think that we've seen a little bit, Matt Chapman signed what I think looks like a very team-friendly deal with the Giants. That was another guy that I had sort of, again, like the flaws are obvious. He's not even really like a much above average hitter anymore. But it's like he did get a contract. Like he's better than the guy that he replaced, you know, like, and I feel like the same thing with Snell. I mean, a team like the Boston Red Sox going into the next season, even if they're not trying to win a World Series or even make the playoffs, like, they should sign one of the two remaining starters. Like, arguably, yeah, they should sign both. They still have money. They print money. And as you said, it's like any team could. I mean, the Mets, the level of luxury tax that they're at, if they sign Blake Snell, they'd wind up with the penalties paying him like $60 million a year or whatever, or it would wind up costing them that much. But I still feel like it's the sort of thing where if you're going to pretend to care about winning, you got to be willing to back that up a little bit.
Yeah,
but the key word there is you have to pretend. Mm. And you have to want that. You have to want to pretend that you want it, and that's a big ask of
heavy ask for a lot of these guys. Yeah. I agree.
We are going to talk more sports with Catherine Chu when we get back. But before we get to break, this week's show is brought to you by EcoWipe, the first mass-produced toilet paper made exclusively from 100% recycled toilet paper. Let's flush climate change down the drain together. With EcoWipe. We'll be right back with Catherine Chu.
Lovely. This episode of The Distraction is brought to you by Wild Grain. Wild Grain is the first ever bake from frozen subscription box for sourdough breads, fresh pastas, and artisan pastries. Every item bakes from frozen in 25 minutes or less with no thawing required. And you can fully customize your Wild Grain box. You can choose any combination of breads, pastas, or pastries. You can even build a box of only breads, or only pastas, or only pastries if you want. I have tried all of them, and I like all of them. The one that we had most recently was the frozen pasta. We went through the breads I wouldn't say disgustingly quickly, but very, very quickly. They were all excellent. Pastries, same deal. Delicious croissants, really a cool thing to be able to have at home. Fresh pasta is one of those deals where I know there's people that make it. I am not one of those people. We got a tiny little kitchen. Getting really fresh tasting, really high quality pasta out your freezer, dunking it in water, and then 7 minutes later eating like you are maybe not in Italy, but in a kitchen that's a little nicer than your own, I found that very clutch. If you want to have that experience for a limited time, you can. You can get $30 off the first box, plus free croissants in every box, when you go to wildgrain.com/distraction to start your subscription. You heard me. That's free croissants in every box and $30 off your first box when you go to wildgrain.com/distraction. That's wildgrain.com/distraction, or you can use promo code distraction at checkout.
And we're back with Catherine Hsu of Defector Media, the upstart
good.
Defector Media. Catherine, you also cover Formula One for us. So as two clueless Formula One people, Roth and I have a couple of questions. First one is about Lewis Hamilton, arguably the greatest racer in the world and perhaps in Formula One history, but he has ceded that title of current best racer to the evil Max Verstappen. But Lewis is going from Mercedes to Ferrari. Will that have any impact on his rivalry with Verstappen?
The hope is yes. I think this is a bit difficult because of how like so much depends on the cars and also how the regulations work. So it's like tampering doesn't exist in Formula One. So he's currently racing for Mercedes but signed with Ferrari after next year. So This year he's still with Mercedes, who are not looking very fast. Ferrari is looking like the clear second best team right now, but the regulations basically change like every like 4 to 5 years. So they changed in for 2022, and that's when Red Bull started running away with it because both Ferrari and Mercedes sort of botched their cars, basically. And then because of the new cap changes where it's like every team can only spend so much money, which is supposed to like result in like some sort of parity with all the teams, but it sort of means that like the top teams can no longer overspend to sort of correct for their errors that they made like the previous year. So now Red Bull is just running away from it. The next one is going to be in 2026, which means that Lewis Hamilton is going to have 1 year with Ferrari under the current regulations, which will probably play out very similarly to how things are going this year still. But in 2026, it's like anyone's game. And I think he's going to get at least 1 year with Ferrari under the current regulations, which will hopefully go better than how it's going with Mercedes right now. And then after that, the hope is that Ferrari will nail the regulations and Lewis will win. At least I like Lewis a lot. So that's my hope. Like,
saying it like the hope, and I'm just sort of like, everybody agrees on this. Really interesting. But it is funny, like for knowing what I know about F1, which is basically nothing beyond what I read on the website, the idea of that institution trying to create parody is really funny to me because it is just like the most plutocratic, like rule averse, like decadent shit in the world. And then the idea of them just sort of trying to be like, well, honestly, what we want ideally is a bunch of teams going 10-7 and like being in the wild card race right to the end of the year. Like, no, you fucking don't, dude. Like, every single person involved in that has been like skipping out on taxes forever. So the dedication to parody feels weird to me. Is that's a thing I'm assuming that the fans want, or that like, because this is, I don't think they do anything different if they didn't have to, right?
I actually can answer this for you.
Okay.
Because I, right before the pandemic, I went to England and to Spain and I profiled Zach Brown, the head of McLaren. Mm-hmm. And Zach, who is an American, he said outright, we're never gonna be as good as Mercedes, Ferrari, and Red Bull because they spend $300 to $500 million and our budget is 200 or something like that. Now it's like, oh, poor guys, you have only $200 million to play with. But all of the constructors, you know, who were trailing those big boys, they were like, this is bullshit. We're never gonna get ahead. We want, like, Zach Brown, among other presidents in that sport, were actively banging the drum for these limits so that they would have a chance. They just wouldn't have had a chance otherwise.
Right. I think that that's correct. It's also tough because, like, the fans definitely want that too, because it's always been true in Formula One that one guy is going to run away with it, basically. But it's better in some years than it is in other years. Like, 2021 was an especially good racing year because there was an actual title fight between, like, two drivers from two different teams, and that was Max and Lewis. And
then right, it came into, like, the final lap, too, right?
And it ended terribly because the FIA were, like,
Wait, what did they do?
So basically, there were like car. This is like F1 has so many niche rules that sometimes
I was going to say, like, don't try to explain it to me like I'm going to understand it. Just get it on the record. I'll look it up later.
But basically, like, Lewis was ahead of Max at the time, and there were like three cars between them. There was a safety car that happened because Nicholas Latifi, who was a pay driver, crashed into a wall. And then, so there was a safety car that came out. And then under rules, you can allow cars that are behind the safety car to unlap themselves. There were basically like three lapped cars between Max and Lewis. And if they had just let the car stay there, then Max would have had to make it pass like three other cars, which would have made it like harder for him to catch Lewis, basically.
Right.
Lewis was on very old tires. Max was on like very new tires. So what happened was the race control allowed the cars between Max and Lewis to unlap, but not any of the other cars to unlap. And they didn't allow all the cars to like fully make their way back into the circuit before the safety car released. And what that basically did was it handed the race over to Max, basically.
So they just basically took themselves out of the position between those two racers? Like, they just like stepped out of the field?
So they basically went back and were like going to tack onto the end.
Okay.
Right. Because they were like lapped on the field, basically.
Oh, all right.
Yeah, but they didn't allow like everyone to unlap either. So it was just like really weird. It was like clearly like against the rules, but race control decided it, and the FIA, and then I think there was like an FIA or F1 investigation. They were like, yeah, we shouldn't have done that, but there's nothing to be done now. So yeah, so that's what happened in 2021 in a close racing year in this like very normal like racing league.
That sounds fun. Oh, by the way, since we were going on, Ryan, with the theme of F1 basking in everything rigged for gross inequality, we do have to give a shout out to Kate Wagner, who published a very, very good good piece about Formula One in Road and Track. The Road and Track took down an hour.
Briefly published it in Road and Track.
Right. Road and Track took it down. And I can give you a bit of insight here, but it was the editor-in-chief at the time was Daniel Pun. They took it down, and then it was reposted over with our friends at Escape Collective. And you should go read it, because I read, and it was very, very good. And I just want to give you a little bit of inside baseball, which is Daniel Pun was not EIC the last time I wrote something for Road and Track. He was one of the editors. He assigned me to write a car review for Audi, and I wrote it, and I got paid. All good there. But it was very curious because I had come from GQ, which had very rigorous fact-checking and copy editing. And like you would write, I'd write a profile and it would go through 5,000 fucking edits and rewrites and all the usual like painful shit that magazine writers have to go through. I delivered my draft to Road and Track of the Audi review and it went right to print. Like they've like fixed some typos and stuff like that, but I never heard from a fact checker or an editor or anything like that. It just went up. So punned when Kate Wagner's post went up, he said, essentially, I think he told this to Defector. He said,
Patrick, the quote.
I was the head of digital. I didn't even realize this was in the pipeline. Once I did, it didn't fit with our voice, which sounds like bullshit to me. I think someone at F1 complained and then they took it down. But it was interesting to me how few, excuse the pun, roadblocks there were two things going, being published up there. I found that surprising, although I shouldn't have in a time when newsrooms are being gutted of basically all essential personnel, say for people who can get a byline, and they're going to be replaced too by like AI Mario or some shit like that.
So can I ask an F1 idiot question about this story?
I will.
So I've been a fan of Kate Wagner's like McMansion coverage, which is, I think, she's best known for, like a legendary Baffler contributor and just also, but I mean, a very funny writer on this stuff. If you're hiring Kate Wagner to write about F1, you know what you're going to get. She's a socialist, you know, and she's a great writer, but she's a skeptic. My question with this, and the thing that didn't compute for me, because again, I have this sort of blurry 30,000 foot view of F1. Catherine, would someone from F1 complain if a writer wrote a story that was like, these people are rich as fuck and they don't care about anything? Like, if you, like, that's not as good as Kate's story was, that's not news about F1, right? Like, would they complain about that? Are they trying to sort of project social responsibility in a way that I've missed in all of my, like, sort of incidental understanding of this sport?
Honestly, I don't really know. The thing about the Kate Wagner piece for me is that there's so little good journalism surrounding Formula One. And I think that like her piece sort of sheds light onto maybe why that's the case. Like almost every single thing about Formula One that you find is like some site called like Racing Fan 123. And then there's like 10,000 ads on the page. And it's just this one interview that this driver gave with one quote that's spread over like five articles to amass clicks. Like that's basically what the state of like F1 journalism generally looks like. So I imagine that like this sort of coverage is not what teams would be used to, or like the F1 as like an industry would be used to ever receiving, because like it doesn't happen. But also I don't, because from how the editor-in-chief put it, it was like he took the initiative to like take it down himself, right? Like there wasn't like a complaint being made to it, so
I don't buy that though.
Yeah, it's weird, but
I don't buy it either.
Yeah, so I can sort of see someone being like, this is bad press to an extent, but also this has never been something that has been, like, I would really say written about this way. And it obviously got a lot of traction outside of, like, F1 fans, too.
Yeah, I mean, it would be a thing where they literally don't know what journalism looks like. They're like, wait a second, this questions us?
Yeah, yeah, that's the impression that I'm getting.
Who does this lady think she is? I will say that.
It's kind of interesting because it's like one of the most popular sports in the world. Like, this can't be the first time that anyone's ever pointed out, like, that they're gaudy and excessive or whatever. But, like, I don't, maybe it is. Like, that idea is crazy to me, but who knows?
I mean, the thing that I wrote for Road and Track was about Zach Brown, and I wrote about the ostentatiousness of F1 and about how just insane it was. And my interviews were, I interviewed Carlos Sainz and Lando Norris. They were both driving for McLaren at the time. Those interviews were very, very carefully staged. I had interviewed them, you know, in the paddock at the McLaren, you know, pop-up tent or whatever the fuck. And the publicist was there, and the publicist had their own recorder next to mine. Like, and when they bust out their own recorder, and this is, I'm not including Aaron Rodgers in this because he does that too, but like, it's not a paranoia thing. It's just a publicist actually doing the job of being like, okay, I have to take every precaution to make sure we don't get fucked here by this rogue reporter who we don't know what they're going to write or anything like that. So they are like any other high level industry. They care about the message, and they want to control it as much as they can control it. Now, Catherine, we have to talk about stupid shit because we've talked about so much serious shit, but it's just not my taste. We have to talk about
it. The listeners would get mad.
We have to talk about what's truly important, and that's hot pots. Because you wrote, you are firmly against dipping sauces with your hot pot because you believe that the broth is sauce enough. Now, I know that not everyone who enjoys hot pots feels the same way. How much blowback did you get for that particular take?
Yeah, were you harassed online by sauce stands?
I was going to ask, did your family get mad at you, actually?
So my family is like firmly on my side about this, because when we do hot pot at home, there's like no dipping sauce. The biggest divide in my family is that like my older sister, when she eats hot pot, she wants rice with her hot pot. To me, that is like insane behavior, because rice takes up too much space in your stomach. Like hot pot is for purely loading up on like meats and like bamboo, you know, like that's what like hot pot is for in like my mind. But, like,
really,
she likes having rice.
It's keto. It's keto. Yeah. Yeah.
It's like so healthy for you.
Would she, does she dump the rice into her
broth? She just has like a bowl of rice and then she eats the stuff with it, which like sort of makes sense to me, because that's how I'm accustomed to eating like pretty much every other meal. Like I need, because like I can't eat like a steak on its own. Like when we make steak at home, we always have it with rice, just like plain white rice, which is just
you have meat, like, veg, starch, like it's pretty
right. That's the main divide in my family. But like I had friends who are like, I love the sauce. And obviously in Slack, like our business guy, Jasper, was going on about how like whenever he goes out to hot pot, he like puts every single sauce thing in his bowl. but personally, I don't like sauce, because then it just tastes like whatever you put in the sauce thing. And I'm like, that sort of defeats the purpose to me. I like what's in the broth normally. And I don't like a lot of the options that they give you with like a lot of people like peanut sauce or like sesame, but like that's too strong for me in terms of like, also just don't like peanut sauce stuff, which is like my personal preference. But like I had like my friends who were like, sauce is great, you're wrong. But the beauty of hot pot is that no one is wrong.
You know, I grew up in the Midwest, because I'm the sort of person who, if I have any Asian food, any Chinese, Korean, Thai, Vietnamese, Japanese, I will always bring a bottle. I was always bring a bottle of soy sauce to the table and be like, you know what? This needs a bit more soy sauce. And I will douse it in soy sauce. And like, and when I go to sushi, when I go eat sushi, I mix the wasabi paste and the ginger into the little bowl, and I make the soup, and Anthony Bourdain would, you know, turn over in his grave if he saw it. But I do all that nasty shit.
So what I like to think of myself not as a cosmopolitan person, but I mean, like, I like to eat food. I had never had hot pot, and I think that there's more.
Wow.
Still haven't. We were planning on doing it last Friday, but everybody was too tired because we went to a hockey game two nights earlier. But I don't think that I've ever been able to draw as one-to-one a connection between reading a post on our website and then being like, I'm going to do that. I think I need to do that.
Oh, yeah. So, it's like, a good sales job.
It is
job.
Like as good as the hot pot blog was, it is also like legitimately inspiring in the most literal sense of the word, in that it inspired me to try to eat it. Can you talk? This is, I don't want to get too like inside baseball on it, but like, what was the process on you deciding to write a blog about how to best enjoy a hot pot experience?
I think it was sort of kicking around in my brain, because it was a holiday season, so we'd had hot pot so much. Because it's like for birthdays or like for Thanksgiving, when my family's together, like hot pot's like a big celebratory meal that we just do on like special occasions. Like it's not like a normal dinner thing for us. So I was thinking about like, wow, it's like the holiday season. We always have hot pot during this. We do like the Monday morning editor check-ins at Defector, and Bert is like my guy, and he comes and he's in the Slack with like me and McKenna, and he's like, oh, what are you thinking about blogging about? And then I toss this like hot pot idea just out there, because it's been kicking around in my brain. And then obviously Bert loves food, so he was like, I would love a hot pot vlog, and I would especially love to know how to do my own hot pot at home. And I was basically, I had a lot of encouragement from like that front too, to just like get it up there. So that's how that happened.
That's how it's supposed to work. That is like the editorial process. I'd love to say that it was more elaborate than that. I don't know that it's like, this is one of those like, don't tell anyone how I live sort of like Simpsons scenarios. But this is where the posts come from. I'm just glad that that it was as linear as that. We do have plans as a team to go to Hot Pot. And I think that Catherine and Jasper are going to be co-captains there, but I'm really looking forward to just like tucking a napkin into my collar, like a cartoon person who's about hamburger, and just letting it happen to me. Like whatever you all tell me to do, I'm going to do.
Also, in defense of rice on the side, if I could, and like the rice was really good, I could probably eat like a metric ton of plain white rice. Like when it's good, I'm like, I just shovel it in there, and there's no bottom. There's no bottom to my bottom. It's just so delicious.
You know who else has that opinion?
Who?
Is former President Donald Trump. Big white rice guy. This is one of those things.
Now you've ruined rice for me. Well done.
Great question, Catherine, because I got a fucking problem. I have an issue with any bit of garbage about him that goes through my brain. I digest all of it. Some of it gets snagged in there on like an upturned grocery cart wheel or something. Like it is, and then I'm stuck for the rest of my life. Like I'm already forgetting the faces of people that I went to middle school with. You know, like I don't like
all these things
that I would love to have in mind. But instead, I'm like, Trump loves white rice. Trump wants two pieces of cake. It's important to him that he have more scoops of ice cream than anyone else. And he makes a big deal of it. I don't want to know that anymore. It's not important for me to know that anymore, really. Like, even if he fucking becomes president again, no one's ever going to be like, what kind of plain foods does he like? And I'll be like, oh, well, but like, I'm stuck with it. I'm stuck with him as a big white rice guy. It was also funny because it was one of those stories when he was president where everybody that works for him is insane too and kind of hates him after a while. And so there, of all the things to give someone anonymity for in a story, to be like, he loves rice. He could eat so much of it. Like the idea that someone had to be Trump's body man for like a year and a half, like being in a limo where he like farts and then it's like, you did that. Like just all those, you have to abase yourself that way. And then all you get out of that experience at the end is that you get to like leak to someone at the Washington Post that he's a big rice guy.
We can't have Jared and Ivanka outed as the source of that.
Right, it does. Much yeah, it wasn't a Haberman joint, so I don't think it was them.
There are parties they would not get invited to if that came out. Let's open up the fun bag. These are real questions from Defector readers and Distraction listeners. Catherine, are you ready for some serious fun bag action?
I'm so ready.
All right, good. This is from James. James writes in, what are the fruits that are better in their dried form? Obviously, dates, figs, and apricots, he says, and dried pears are top tier. Do you agree with all that, Catherine? What is your favorite dried fruit?
I do love dried apricots. I also love dried mangoes, too. I think this is one of those things where I went through like a really big freeze-dried like fruits phase, and I was like in elementary school and swimming, which is just like we get out of the pool and then I get my bag of like freeze-dried strawberries and bananas.
Yeah. Little weird pouch.
Yeah.
Is that like when they give you astronaut food like in class? They're like, this is what Neil Armstrong had to eat.
Yeah, and it's like texturally, it's just exactly the same.
It's a cube of freeze-dried ice cream.
Yeah, it's so good, though. It's just, like, it doesn't taste, like, very much. And, like, texturally, it's, like, a little bit, like, I would say styrofoam adjacent, but it's so good.
Yeah. So, wait, do you like dried mango more than fresh mango?
No. I'm a big fresh fruit head. And especially, like, there are so many good, like, farmers markets in Philly where they have like, so now my fruit consumption is based on like going to the farmer's market every Saturday and getting like, like speaking of depraved college habits, like I would go to the farmer's market on Saturdays and get like 10 apples. Then I would finish all those apples by like Wednesday. And then there'd be the Wednesday farmer's market on campus. And I go to the Wednesday.
That is the most wholesome college behavior I have ever heard of in my life.
And get like four more apples to tide me over until Saturday.
Yeah,
I mean, I went to college with guys who like would have Gatorade bottles filled with dip spit like on the, like accumulated on their windowsill as like trophies, you know. Like,
we've come a long way as a society.
Not a fan of fresh fruit. Not a fresh fruit head. Donald Trump. I learned that. That stuck in my
thinks that it is a foreign tendency. It does seem like you would be. Can I just one point of order on this question? Dates are not dried. That's just what the way dates are.
I was going to ask about that.
Yeah, when you see, so this was, I've always been, so Catherine and I are from similar parts of New Jersey. Like, there's some crucial differences, but they're not really very crucial. Like, it is all, it's the same shit. It's the same stuff growing everywhere. And like, so, and you know, honestly, as like also as a green market dependent adult, like we basically have the same habits on a slightly different cadence. I went to school in California and was blown away by the amount of shit that just grows places. Like, not just in terms of, you know, in a farm sense, but I remember walking to class my school was in LA County, Southern California, and just there would be trees from people's property hanging over the sidewalk, and I would just grab like an apricot or a nectarine off it and just eat it on my way to class and be like, this is it. Like, why would anyone live anywhere else? And then, of course, I moved right back to the East Coast and have only gone back to visit. But when we went to Palm Springs for a quick little trip before my wife started her new job, I had that experience with date palms, which are, I mean, a lot of them are being grown and sort of harvested, but there are places where there's just dates like falling basically onto the sidewalk, like fruiting date palm trees.
I remember that when I went to Palm Springs, like you go on the road and it's just like dates, like there's signs, like.
So that didn't get old. I was only there for a week, but it rocked. Like I also feel like, dates as a, I remember having them when I was in the Middle East, when I was reporting from Qatar for back a million years ago at SB Nation. And they would just be like, the way that you might find like mints someplace at like a hotel or whatever, every place would just have like a little bowl of dates out.
Bad dates.
It rocked. Yeah, it was. I narrowly avoided a Sulla scenario.
I want to defend fresh figs to James, because if you have a quality fresh fig, it's pretty, pretty fucking solid. And
that's
like sometimes
deluxe.
But sometimes with apricots, I do think a dried apricot is usually going to be better, particularly if it's been glazed. I love a glazed dried apricot.
I love fresh apricots.
Yeah, their fresh apricots are really good. I like dried apricots. I do not like the glazed dried fruit, though. That to me kind of flattens it. The kind of like that glacé, like shiny French. That's what you're talking about, right? Where they're just sugar them.
Kiss my ass for not liking it.
All right, man. Okay.
Fuck you, man.
We disagree on this podcast once every 6 weeks. They're out there, Catherine. You see them in stores and stuff, like those kiwis that kind of like glow like a CGI sort of product. Like there's something that's not quite right about it.
Yeah. No, they're they're actually quite fancy. Like they're kind of expensive. One time I bought them on Amazon, like imported from Australia to treat myself. And my wife was like, what are you doing? And I was like, whatever. They're good. Yeah. And like sometimes they'll dip half of them in dark chocolate and it's just magnifique. Also, shout out to Apple Chips, because you know the quality of grocery store apples. You're playing with fire when you buy apples at the grocery store, right? But an apple chip, usually pretty good.
Yeah.
Usually pretty solid.
I think, so are we in agreement here? On Catherine's freeze-dried habit, you said you've left that in the past. Now you've entered the world of fresh fruit. I like dried fruit to have some texture that is not, I don't like anything that feels crunchy. I don't mind it being kind of uncannily chewy, though. Like, to me, that's kind of like what I'm signing up for there.
Yeah, I want to feel like I'm eating an ear.
Yep, that's definitely what dried apples are kind of like. Like, they all have that feeling of being like made at home by a sincere and committed hippie. It's just like a real earthy element to it.
That's the charm. Let's do one more question and then we'll bail. This is from Chris Catherine. He writes in the hey, you can't park here, keep it exchange at an airport is a staple of rom-coms, usually when the male lead is desperately racing to stop his beloved from getting onto a plane to France or whatever. Do you think anyone has ever actually done this at the terminal stop in person? If so, how much money would that end up costing them in fines? Do you think anyone has ever left their car?
Just abandoned their car?
Just abandoned their car at the terminal to run in and chase down their beloved. Do you think that's actually happened?
See, I'm like so maybe monetarily. So I don't own a car. Well, let's get that out there. I can drive.
I'm sorry. We have to erase this podcast. And we can't. We only have car owners on the podcast.
It's going
to
jeopardize our sponsorships.
Yep. Sorry.
But no, I mean, I can't imagine owning a car, let alone can I imagine being like, fuck off. I have to chase Sandra Bullock to the TSA area. Like, no, not at all.
But I can sort of understand this desire to like not want to look for like a proper parking spot, because I was in San Francisco on vacation, my friend and I were in like Point Reyes, which is this like tiny town, but we were like parking to go to this place to get like these really good sandwiches. And then there was this one like half farm looking thing where clearly a bunch of people like parked there before, because on the fence there were like 10 no parking signs. And then she was like, I don't really want to parallel park this car, so I just want to like pull it in and then we can like go get sandwiches. But then we looked at the 10 no parking signs. We're like, okay, maybe we just like find like a proper parking space to like
this person means it like a little bit too much.
like we don't want to test, like maybe if there's just one, like 5 minutes in the store, it'll be totally fine. But like once you get above like the five threshold, I think it's when you're really like, let's just bite the bullet here and just not risk it.
That's the equivalent of like bumper stickers on a car or whatever, where it's like when you start, there's like a point where you see enough of them where you're just like, don't make eye contact, keep this moving. Under no circumstances can you interact with this person.
Oh my God. There's this bumper sticker I saw. I can't remember what it was, but it was something along the lines of like I am a girl and I drive, which is just so like, I don't know.
It's about half the people driving can say that.
I am a girl boss and I have arms.
But like,
sorry, that patriarchy.
Yeah, right.
Speaking of my San Francisco friend, she got this bumper sticker and she's waiting until she gets her own car because she's still driving her parents' car. But it says like, I like bugs and I vote, which I think is like a great like threatening aura for like a bumper sticker to have.
Yeah, those that method, because there used to be when Drew and I were kids that anytime you saw a bumper sticker like that, it was basically someone threatening to kill you. Like it was, they were sort of like I'm heavily armed and like I have a mood disorder and you just have to be like, all right, got it. But there's been some really intriguing twists on those. The one that I think has gotten a sort of internet fame, there used to be a sort of like keep honking, I'm reloading or whatever, you know, and there's a version of it now that is keep honking, I'm listening to Alice Coltrane's 1974 expressionistic jazz masterpiece, you know, Journey in Sachi Dananda or whatever. And there is one of those in my neighborhood on a car that also has an Indiana Fellowship of Police Officers license plate frame. And I think that I would like to meet that person and figure out what their deal is.
Is there a third one? Is there a nice people swallow one like on the other side?
No, that's the thing. If there was another one that
Gas or grass.
Right. Yeah. Like, so I was like, all right, what type of maniac am I working with here? Like, but there's nothing. It's only those two signifiers, which are completely decoupled from each other. In lieu of answering this question, I will say that I think that the sort of security theater at airports has made it so that watching, like, not just a romantic comedy from, like, 1995, but, like, basically any movie involving travel from then. Home Alone is a really good example.
Yeah, where you can just go to the gate.
Yes. Or, like, this is a lot of things from, like, the 70s where, like, a guy, like, Gene Hackman walks to the TWA counter and is like, one for fucking Bangkok, please. And they're like, sure, that'll be $175. And he gives them money and he gets a ticket. And then he just goes and gets on the airplane. All of that feels like it is made in a parallel universe. Like, it is increasingly unidentifiable as something that could happen in our own.
Well, also, because the drop-off area at an airport, there's more cops there than there are at like a fucking inauguration. Like, you're not like, I would be terrified. Like, I get terrified just unloading the car because I'm not in the car. So it's like, expect any second Highway Patrolman Bob to be like, what are you doing here? You know, like, I do want to end with one story. You guys were talking about car stickers, and I have to tell you this story. And you guys know the story, but I'm going to tell it anyway because the audience doesn't know. But my daughter got into college. We were very proud, and we got to buy the car decal, right? That's like the ultimate symbol of suburban parent pride. You get to put the car decal. So we go. Yeah,
they also do that in New Jersey.
My wife buys it at the university's, like, online swag store. Guess who controls that university? This is a D3 university. This is not fucking Bama or anything, but take a wild guess who runs that store.
Would it be the people that control everything having to do with merchandising for institution in the United States?
It was a Fanatics experience, and we got the Fanatics experience because the sticker arrived, and first of all, like, the backing broke. Secondly, it was the name of the university. Each letter was peel off. So it wasn't one whole sticker.
Oh my God.
Like, you had to place the letters yourself. Like, you had to
line them up yourself?
Yeah, I had to line them up. Like, I was fucking stitching a fucking jersey or something like that.
Oh my God.
And like, what?
Breaking up the ruler to make sure it's straight.
And the sticker cost like $20. So it was like, my wife was like, what the fuck? And like, she had to like, she had to like carefully place it. And like, I ended up buying like counterfeit ones off of Amazon and putting them on my car. And so that's the Fanatics experience. They can't even make a fucking sticker.
Were you able to be like in that moment to be like, this is what I'm always so upset about. Like, this is my thing. Like,
oh yeah, no, like, I sent them the link. I sent them the fuck Fanatics link and they died laughing. But we must go on. Eric Silver is our producer. Brandon Grugel is our editor. Our theme song is by Kirk Hamilton. Ads and production services are by Multitude. And you can subscribe to Defector.com. Just go to Defector. Hit the subscribe button. You can also email us at distraction@defector.com or even call us at 909-726-3720 and leave a message. That's 909-PANERA-0. And you can find Roth and me and Catherine Hsu all writing at Defector every day, every week. And that is going to be such a good time for you. Catherine, thank you for coming on. You are a fantastic guest.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you for having me.
All right, we will see you next week, guys.
Bye.
Bye.